Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're kicking off today's show by talking about the one-year anniversary of Brexit, the UK election, and the tragic Grenfell Tower in London, which killed 79 people. The tragedy is getting widespread media focus, media coverage, with a very sharp focus on austerity, deregulation, and inequality in the UK. In a recent piece for The Guardian, today's guest, Paul Mason, writes, quote, "British public life right now is in the midst of a major emotion-driven change. There is outrage over the symbolic neglect that lies behind the Grenfell tragedy. There is a astonishment at the arrogance that lay behind the May cabal's decision to risk government stability for a needless election. There is fear stalking the ruling class. Meanwhile, among the progressives, half of the electorate, there is a sense of hope and expectation." Paul Mason is a writer and broadcaster covering the economy and social justice for The Guardian. Hi, Paul. Welcome back to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Paul, can you hear us?
I can now, yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you for joining us, Paul. Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So what caught your attention this week, Paul?
Well, it's the journalism of the British press covering this horrific fire that we had in a housing project called the Grenfell Tower in London. And, you know, there's been some really standout coverage by newspapers. Strangely enough, to say that our London Evening Standard here in the United Kingdom is the giveaway free newspaper on the metro stations. It's now edited by a former Conservative minister, George Osborne, who was our finance minister until a few months ago, and it's been very good. It, like many other essentially right-wing newspapers, have had to start from the premise, which is the premise of the entire disaster, that this was an entirely avoidable fire. At least 79 people are dead in a public housing project, and it was a mass grave of the class war, unfortunately, because it is very likely that negligence has been taking place in this in the management of this tower block for years. The residents were complaining for years about the lack of safety, and some of the people who were leading the complaints looked like they died in the fire.
This is getting so much attention, Paul, and as I said, there's such a sharp focus on inequality in the UK and then also here in the United States. You were interviewed for The Nation magazine, and that headline is "The British Ruling Class is in Full Panic Mode." A couple of other headlines for Truthout: "London Fire Fuels Movement to Tackle Inequality in Britain." And then for your paper, an architect wrote a piece called "Architects Like Me Know the Fire Was an Avoidable Tragedy." Another one, "The Grenfell Tower Fire Was the End Result of a Disdainful Housing Policy." This was written by a housing policy activist. So it's getting really good attention. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, in many ways, this tragedy is like the Britain's version of Hurricane Katrina, in the sense that it dramatizes a bigger problem. So this tower block was built in the 1970s. It would not be built today under modern building regulations, but it is a large block, very iconic, right in the middle of the richest area in Britain. So surrounding it is Notting Hill, which your listeners may remember from a famous romantic comedy movie 15 years ago. Notting Hill is the area where very rich people live. Now, they, in other words, woke up a week ago, looked up in the sky, and saw that the housing of their poorest neighbors on fire uncontrollably. Now, it's also got to be said, it's very rare, even in less developed countries, for a tower block to go up in flames, because they're designed to try and contain fire. And usually what people are told is, if there's a fire in a tower block, you shut your door and you stay where you are, because it's the movement of air through the block that's going to kill you. But on this occasion, what happened is they did exactly that, but it looks like the cladding, so the exterior wall that had been added very recently to make it look nicer, was not up to the right standard, and it indeed engulfed the tower block in flames. I think, you know, there were at one point yesterday being named by the government 600 blocks that may also be at risk of this. But even if that turns out to be a too high figure, what's true is that everybody can now imagine either living in a place like this. Many of us have lived in that kind of housing. Or we know somebody who does, you know, somebody who cleans our office, who drives our Uber taxi. These are the poorest migrant, often sometimes undocumented people. And we saw that their dwellings go up in flames before our eyes. And I think it's had a huge political impact across parties. There's got to be, this local government, we call them boroughs, it's like a sort of mini town council, was in charge of this. It was a notorious conservative right-wing council that had, I would argue, had very little care and attention for its poorest people. But it's also there, by the grace of God, go other councils that do pride themselves on having a good attitude towards housing and poverty, because it looks like the mistake that was made here was a mistake ultimately traceable to the removal of regulations on buildings.
Right.
And so, just like in Katrina, there's going to be a big investigation now about who. You remember in Katrina, it was the removal of the investigations and the removal of the regulations that required the water barriers to be at a certain height and strength. Ultimately, that caused them to fail. Something failed here, and somebody at some point has taken away a vital regulation or an inspection regime. And I think we're quite close to getting to the bottom of what that was.
Paul, just to give listeners a sense of the kind of inequality that we're talking about, I heard a BBC reporter right after this happened saying, this is a neighborhood in which people spend more on homes, on bags, on jewelry, than the people in the tower will make in a lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, you know, London is now an extreme global city. I don't think there is a single city in the United States, even Los Angeles, for example, that can match it for the level of inequality and the global scope of that. So a place like Notting Hill, you've got these big old Georgian era, so 250-year-old houses, painted white. They'll be selling for £5 million, £10 million. The people living in them will either be in the finance industry or very rich people from the creative industry, like movie directors, or more likely than anything else, they will have been bought by foreign speculators, people from the Gulf monarchies, people from Russia. So these are people to whom walking into a very expensive watch emporium and buying something for, you know, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 pounds is not, you know, unusual. And next to them are the people who, in this tower, are the people who drive the Uber cars, the people who clean the offices, the people who are the security guys on the doors of clubs and pubs here in London. It turns out, it looks like some of them were undocumented, so we'll never know how many people actually lived there, i.e. they were migrants who didn't have papers. But many of them were first or second generation migrants, and the levels of poverty, look, what we're not looking at is unemployment, because here in the United Kingdom there is high employment. That's why we have a big migrant population. But the jobs these people were doing would have often been very precarious and poorly paid. And the point is, when they complained to the local government that ran this place, they said the work wasn't safe. They wrote in a blog, it will take a tragedy until they do something. They weren't listened to, because politics in London has been run in favor of the rich for a long time. And, you know, there are, you know, the free market economic miracle that we're supposed to have had has inserted all kinds of market relationships between the people in this tower owned by the local government and the local government itself. They inserted another layer of management organization, as it was called, to represent, so-called, the people in the tower. It just so happens that the people who ran the management organization weren't listening to the people in the tower. And this is a kind of parable of modern neoliberal economics, that when you insert market relationships into democracy, the democracy bit tends to die away.
Paul Mason is a writer and broadcaster covering the economy and social justice for The Guardian. And right now we're talking about media coverage of the tragic Grenfell Tower in London, which killed 79 people. And it's getting so much media attention. Most of the focus is on deregulation, inequality, and austerity in the UK. And you can say that so many of these things are happening here in the Bay Area. And then I was just on the Big Island. Same thing, Paul. So many massive homes are being bought as either investments or they're left empty. It's just happening all over the place. In fact, one of your colleagues 3 years ago, Robert Booth, had a piece called Inside Billionaire's Row, London's Rotting Derelict Mansions Worth £350 Million. A Guardian investigation revealed that there are an estimated $350 million worth of vacant properties on the most prestigious stretch of the Bishop's Avenue in North London. They're completely empty. People do not live in them. They rot and they still make millions.
Yeah, and you know, I think that what's global, what's driving this, of course, is the policy of quantitative easing, central banks printing money. That flows then into the into asset markets like stocks and shares on the stock market, but property as well. And so, you know, what we're looking at in large parts of London, and I think it's large parts of the developed world also, is speculative building. So a builder will build a new block of luxury apartments. Here in Britain, they're obliged to put some cheaper social housing into there. But it's a license to make money. Meanwhile, the government, which in Britain used to build, you know, 500,000 homes a year sometimes for poor people to live in. If you fly over London, if you're flying in, you look at the outskirts, these are huge areas with gardens, houses, semi-detached houses, which were once owned and built by the public, that often have been sold off. But more importantly, the government no longer builds. And in our last election, this was a big issue between Labour, Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, and the ruling Conservatives, because Corbyn said, look, we're going to build 500,000 homes a year for poor people. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why we're living through this sea change of political consciousness right now, because it's getting serious now. It's no longer housing, such a boring issue, isn't it? I mean, who wants to be a housing expert? But when you look up in the sky and there's a thing on fire, and I'm afraid, you know, really traumatic stories of people throwing their babies out of windows, trying to jump out of the windows. Firefighters very, very traumatized by the whole experience. But people going through that place now, trying to find bodies, can't find them because the heat was so intense, they've been incinerated. When that's serious, that's not a boring policy issue. That's as serious as your life. And many people are realizing, though, in the United Kingdom that something's got to be done to stop the privileging of the rich and to make local governments listen to the people they're supposed to be serving.
Well, you can join us at 866-798-8255. What do you make of the coverage about what happened in London, but just inequality overall, because this is happening here in the Bay Area, just in terms of inequality and housing that is unaffordable for so many people. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Paul, the Daily Beast reports that unlike the private high-rises built for the wealthy and businesses in central London, Grenfell had no sprinkler system, only one staircase. And then you were talking about the cladding. There are a lot of reports out there about how this cladding has been banned in the United States.
Yeah.
And then those overseeing the construction reportedly opted to buy $28 panels instead of the $30 fireproof panels. And this decision saved about $6,000 in total.
Yeah, I mean, it looks, in other words, like that's not even the kind of decision that you would make. You know, the people commissioning this building work have $250 million of reserves. And, you know, I think, in other words, it looks like a penny-pinching issue, but the most likely thing is that the building material has been in some way misclassified, or the inspection has been done wrongly, because it does. As the firefighters, there's a video from one of the firefighters' mobile phones as they're going into the building, and they're saying, "How is this possible? You know, it's not supposed to be possible. It's there's been a regulatory or inspection failure, and that will be traced to politics." But look, you know, while that's going on, the social issue around that tower block is dramatized every night for us on our TV screens. You know, in the days following the disaster, this local council that had been all too willing to, you know, sort of do kind of vanity projects aimed at kind of pleasing the rich inhabitants of that area, were nowhere to be seen sometimes actually in terms of helping the people who'd been made homeless. The chief executive of the local council, Kensington and Chelsea, is called, has resigned. But there's big pressure now on the political leadership, which is, as I say, is conservative. So the other thing is here in the United Kingdom, when people are, you know, under stress, when people are, it's not often that we see ordinary people very vocal and very articulate, giving vox pops live to broadcasters, and being able to lay out and dramatize the basic issues of their life, the fact that they're poor, the fact that they are ignored by the authorities, that they complained and nobody listened. And to give you a parallel, I think it reminds me a little bit of the early pictures that came out of Ferguson when the Ferguson protests started, because suddenly you started to see black people, and many of the people in this tower are black or Asian, people of color, basically suddenly given a platform live on TV and using that platform to make very articulate critiques of the system. And that's why I think it's going to be changing British politics in the long term, way after we find what the actual technical cause of the fire was.
Paul Mason is a writer and broadcaster covering the economy and social justice for The Guardian. And Paul, it's been 1 year since Britain voted to leave the EU. It's been 1 year since the Brexit vote. And we have a question from a listener, Martin, who says, will the Theresa May election fiasco and the uproar after the fire result in the reversal of Brexit?
The two things are certainly feeding off each other, because Theresa May, first of all, didn't turn up to see the victims, and when she did, every time she does, she seems to make some kind of presentational mistake. She's been heckled. She's been accused of being heartless. She actually made an apology on behalf of the national government for the way that the whole thing has been handled since the tragedy. So the she had this election fiasco 2 weeks ago where she called an election that didn't need to happen to try and strengthen her majority in our parliament, and instead she lost her majority in our parliament. And the reason she wanted to strengthen the majority was in order to be able to negotiate Brexit in a stronger and more decisive way. And so the outcome of the election is the Brexit negotiations are really in chaos. What is likely for your listener is, and for your listeners, is what is likely is that she has to moderate her demand for what she called a hard Brexit. She's been striding around Europe saying, hey, if you don't give me a good deal, I'm going to walk away. And we just walk away from Europe without a deal. That's gone. She can't do that. She hasn't got a mandate and a majority in Parliament to deliver that. So she has to start negotiating in earnest. And scandalously, from my point of view, their negotiating strategy is to just turn up to meetings with no proposals. She's gone today to Brussels to talk to the Europeans about some kind of deal about how many migrants can stay who live here who came from Europe, and they've accused her of just total unseriousness and lack of specifics, and really it couldn't be going worse for us. The process of Brexit, even though I've got to say probably most people in this country, still a rough majority, would still support the idea of leaving the European Union.
And what effect will this have on the economy? You write that Brexit was an unwanted gift to British business. Even in its softest form, it means 10 years of disruption, inflation, higher interest rates, a drain on the public purse. It disrupts the supply of cheap labor and threatens to leave the UK as an economy without a market.
Yeah, look, nobody supported Brexit before it happened. And British business is now trying to make the best of it and trying to basically mitigate the disaster. So they're trying to have the softest form of Brexit. There's a thing called the single market, so we could remain in the market for goods and services even if we left Europe. That's all possible. Norway, Switzerland have these kind of deals. But what is strange is that the political right flipped over into supporting Brexit. The strange thing is that Theresa May and large numbers of the Conservative ruling party flipped over into what would be the equivalent here of your of Donald Trump's America First economics. And I think there's a lesson that we can both countries can draw, and that is that big business always claims to be pro-globalization, but when they're confronted with a political fact that is economic nationalist, some of them leap on board quite quickly. You saw that with Trump. You saw the way some of the investment banks tried to leap on board with Trump. We've seen parts of our ruling elite try to leap on board with Brexit, but then that's gone wrong for them. And so I think all we can say is that we're in a period politically where people who were told everything was going to be all right and politics is boring and there's nothing really to decide anymore are going to be really shocked, because every day you wake up to some kind of dramatic event in politics, as you do over there in the United States. Mm. We are beginning to do so here, because the Brexit process is a chaotic and indeterminate process. We don't know what the outcome is going to be.
And as you write in a lot of stories about Jeremy Corbyn, so many young people are now involved in politics. A lot of new people are involved, just like we saw here in the U.S. And then the negotiations started this week. So much is happening right now in your part of the world, Paul. What's in store for the U.K., and how is that getting covered?
Well, look, it's getting covered by the fact that the press cannot talk about anything else other than what is effectively a rolling national crisis. Now, What I think is important to say is that, you know, we Jeremy Corbyn, who's the leader of our Labour Party, probably roughly the equivalent of the Democrats, he is roughly the equivalent of Bernie Sanders. And unlike Bernie, he won. He gained control of the party, and then in the first election that he carried out, despite being absolutely vilified by the press, really in a terrible way, he made gains. And on the back of that, and the handling of this disaster, the fire disaster, which he turned up immediately and was very human with the victims in a way the Prime Minister wasn't, his reputation is growing. And I think that large parts of the kind of rich and the elite in Britain are having to get their heads around the fact that he may win the next election. And so they're going to do their best to make sure that election is as far away as possible. But because they have a minority government, there's no majority in our parliament, the election could happen more or less at any time. And so we could, I mean, don't hold your breath, but Britain could become the first major country that actually breaks with neoliberal economics. If Corbyn gets in, if he's supported by, we have a progressive Scottish Nationalist Party in the north of Britain, the SNP, if he's supported by them, supported by the Greens, they could make a radical break with free market economics. They could do, in other words, what Sanders talked about. We could be doing it within 2 years here.
You said that Jeremy Corbyn has been vilified in the media. How has that media coverage changed, if at all, since the election?
Well, look, this is an important difference, and I think the US listeners should understand, between the British media and the US media. Our TV, our broadcasters, have to obey certain rules. Sometimes they push them a bit, but the rules are generally enforced by the government, and those rules are on neutrality and impartiality.
Hmm.
What the first important thing that does is it kills fake news. So what happens typically in the American media is the fake news sources on the edge, you know, the typical Breitbart types, fake news people, they put out some crazy story, and then Fox will pick it up, or they'll pick up a version of it. And then it doesn't really matter what the newspapers say, because it's already out there on cable and on network TV. That can't happen in Britain. So fake news, it gets produced, but it gets stifled at source. So that's one good thing. Hmm. The other thing is, in an election here in the UK, the TV have to be extra specially impartial. And so Corbyn suddenly was getting a hearing that he hadn't been getting before, because they've been ignoring him. And as a result, the final thing is, we have these really right-wing tabloids, you know, similar, say, to the New York Post, really, really scuzzy tabloid newspapers. They virtually accused Corbyn and Labour Party, and me. I've been in there. I've been day after day. I'm a subject, apparently, of some of the story. I've stopped reading them. But, you know, they accuse us of being a threat to national security, sympathising with terrorism, you know, on the basis of support for Irish nationalist human rights, you know, 30 years ago, for example. So 14 pages in two newspapers about Corbyn's links to terror on election day. What happened? He got 40% of the vote. You know, 12, 13 million people just said, well, we're going to ignore this stuff. Hmm. That's caused a bit of a crisis in the tabloid news media because they thought they were being listened to. And what is quite obvious is large numbers of young people, not particularly radical people, but just young professionals are looking at this stuff and saying, nothing in these newspapers is true. And that's a lesson for the media worldwide, I think.
Hmm. Well, so many of us here in the U.S. are obviously watching what's happening in the U.K. So thank you so much for joining us, Paul, and we'd love to have you back soon.
A pleasure.
Thank you. Paul Mason is a writer and broadcaster covering the economy and social justice for The Guardian. You can see his latest stories at yourcallradio.org. And coming up after the break, we're going to be speaking with USA Today's investigative reporter, Brett Murphy. He spent a year looking at the exploitation of truckers in the United States. He found that so many of them work past exhaustion, they're forced into debt, and they're often left with nothing. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point. Host Lauren Schiller in conversation with San Francisco Opera Orchestra percussionist Patty Nemi. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up next week, we're putting shows together about the rise of corporate monopolies. The latest is Amazon's bid to buy Whole Foods. We're also putting shows together about workplace culture and sexual harassment and nonprofits struggling to survive and pay their rent here in the Bay Area. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and it's the day that we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And sometimes we find investigations that stand out, and we definitely found one this week by USA Today's Brett Murphy. Brett spent 1 year looking at the exploitation of truck drivers in the United States. They pieced together accounts from more than 300 drivers. They listened to hundreds of hours of sworn labor dispute testimony and reviewed contracts that have never been seen by the public. This investigation is called Rigged, Forced into Debt, Worked Past Exhaustion, and Left with Nothing. Hi, Brett. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. I also want to mention that your photographer was Omar O'Neilius. There's an amazing photos and videos that accompany this investigation. And wow, this is just incredible information that you uncovered. First off, what sparked this investigation?
It actually started in Oakland when I was covering the longshoremen strike almost 2 years ago now. I was kind of reporting on some local businesses how the slowdown at the ports was affecting them. And one day I was kind of down by the terminals walking around, and I got to talking to some of these truck drivers. There was a line of them going all the way into downtown Oakland, and I just sort of walked it, and I kept hearing their stories, and kind of the same thing kept coming up again and again, that, hey, at the end of this week, because I'm not moving any containers, I might have to owe my boss money. I'm going to be in the hole like $60 or $10, and I'm not going to go home with any money this week. And that kind of struck me. And the more I learned about their contract with their bosses, the more it sounded pretty legal.
And now you looked at what's happening in LA ports. There are 16,000 truck drivers whose job is to move half of all American imports from the ports near Los Angeles. And they haul shipping containers short distances to warehouses and train yards so goods can get to big box stores. And for the past decade, you report that these drivers, most of them immigrants who speak little English, have faced some of the same basic work arrangements as Uber drivers. They're mostly independent contractors, and they basically have no rights. Can you talk about why you think this is not getting as much attention, for example, as some of the other, like Uber and Lyft, because those are now getting a lot more attention about the fact that they don't have many labor rights?
Yeah, so we actually just published kind of a follow-up story on how it's similar to Uber, but also how it's very, very different. Hmm. It's different in the way that these guys can't leave. That is kind of a thread we kept noticing throughout the reporting, is that the way the arrangement works is that they pay into this truck, right? It's deducted from their weekly pay. It's the cost of the truck, the lease, the insurance, the diesel for it, the maintenance, and then anything else the company wants to take out of their checks, right? So it can be for the office toilet paper, for parking fees, for drug testing. It's all deducted right from their check. And what they look at it as, what these truck drivers think they're doing, is paying into an investment. So they end up kind of pouring all of their savings into it. Some guys have gone bankrupt. Their houses have got foreclosed on. They lose sort of everything trying to pay for this truck that they never should have gotten financing for to begin with. They didn't qualify. So what they kind of look at it as is, if I'm to quit, if I'm to walk away from this job right now, I lose tens of thousands of dollars and years of an investment. We found some guys who had been fired after 4 years of paying into the thing. And they can get fired, we found, for pretty much anything. It's written right into the contract that the company has the right just to fire somebody and then keep both the truck and everything they had paid into it. And what that, you know, often comes down to is guys missing time for getting sick, for going to bury their mother in a funeral. And when they come back, the company just sort of fired them, and they lose everything. So it's like Uber in that they're all independent contractors or classified as independent contractors, even though the courts and the Labor Commission keeps finding that they're actually employees. So it's like Uber in that way, that they don't have any of the basic, you know, employee rights that everyone kind of understands. But in pretty much every other way, it's very unique to this industry, because they can't leave, and the company kind of can use their weekly debt as a cajole to make them kind of do whatever they want. So it's different in a lot of extreme ways, but similar in the fact that they're all independent contractors without employee rights.
You report that part of the problem is these truck drivers do not understand what's in the contracts they're signing.
Yeah, that was a huge part of it. And this all started almost a decade ago, actually. They had all been sort of legit small businesses before 2008. They all drove their own trucks. These were clunkers, like things they could afford with 2 million miles on them for like $10,000, right? Because they're just doing short haul routes, so it's not a big risk. And they were doing fine. They were making a good enough living. But then in 2008, LA and Long Beach said, no more clunkers at the port. These things are spewing diesel exhaust into the air. We need to have newer trucks. So that's a huge, like, tectonic shift in an industry that had been deregulated since 1980. To drop this environmental regulation meant $2.5 billion of new capital had to come from somewhere. And the companies, all these trucking companies, that in an already very competitive field, they can't adjust their prices too much. They weren't willing to take on this new price. They couldn't. A lot of them would have went under. So they came up with this idea to draw up these lease-to-own agreements. And what that meant for the drivers is that they showed up to work one day, they walked in, and the boss said, listen, you can't drive that truck at the port anymore. It just got banned. But there's one waiting outside in the parking lot for you. And if you sign this, in 5 or 7 years, you can own the thing. The pay will be better. It'll be fine. Just sign here so you can keep working. And the guys, you know, they don't speak any English. 90% are from Central and South America down there. They don't have, you know, any sort of legal backgrounds. A lot of time it's elementary school education. They just signed because they knew if they didn't work that day, it could mean big trouble for paying that week's rent. You know, they have to keep working. Pretty much. So they all sort of signed. A lot of guys asked to have it translated because they don't speak English. And the company said no. A lot of time the company didn't let them bring it home to review with, you know, a lawyer or anything. So they just sort of were coerced into this deal that they didn't know really what they were getting into.
Give us a sense of how this industry works. You report that the retail brands that are using these trucking companies are everyday brands: Target, Hewlett-Packard, Home Depot, Hasbro, J.Crew, UPS, Goodyear, Costco, Ralph Lauren, and more. I'm guessing that most people have never heard of most of these trucking companies that are in your story. For example, QTS is one of them. Harbor Trucking Association is another. Can you just explain how this whole process works?
Yeah, so I most of the retailers themselves wouldn't have heard of the trucking companies. When I was reporting and I was calling all the retailers and telling them what I had found, often they didn't even know who was moving their containers down there. It would take them some time to go find out from their logistics departments, who would have to make a lot of calls and figure it out. Because most of the time, these retailers aren't directly hiring the trucking companies. They're hiring contractors or subcontractors, and then the shipping company will hire them. So it's very deep dug into their supply chain. It's only a tiny little part of it, but it's a really crucial part, right? Mm-hmm. Stuff has to get off the pier. Other times, the retailer has more direct relationships with these trucking companies. We have a story coming out a week from today on some of these more direct relationships and the direct role a lot of these retailers played in setting up this system the way it is now. But when I asked them, you know, if they had felt any sort of responsibility for the labor practices on their supply chain for all these violations that we found, we pretty much told them what was going on and kind of what they thought about it. And a lot of them came back to us and said, you know, it's not our responsibility to be policing our stateside supply chain business practices. These are contractors of subcontractors. It's not really, you know, it's not up to us to make sure that they're following the law. We expect that they do. We have a code of conduct and social responsibility policies that we expect everyone on our supply chain to follow them. They do audits overseas, but it doesn't look like they've been paying too much attention stateside to what's going on with these trucking companies. So we're thinking that, you know, after there's been more kind of awareness around it, after there's been more stories reported on it, hopefully from us, they'll maybe start taking a look, and then we can, you know, keep reporting on how the industry might be changing a little bit.
Today we're speaking with Brett Murphy. He's an investigative reporter with USA Today, and he spent a year looking at the exploitation of truckers in the United States. You can find his story at yourcallradio.org. In this story are incredible photos by Omar Onelius, along with video. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. We've done a lot of shows about this supply chain, how so much of the stuff is made in places like China, Bangladesh, Vietnam, how those workers are treated. And then we've done shows about what happens when the ships are sent by ship to the United States. We've talked about how those workers are treated. And now we're talking about how the people who drive this stuff from the ports to the big box store are treated. We've also talked about people who work in these warehouses. But there's exploitation all along the way. So what questions do you have for Brett? And then for those of us who buy this stuff, I'll ask Brett, what kind of voice can we have to talk about the exploitation of these workers and to ask how these workers are treated? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And what are your thoughts about coverage of these issues? Brett, you were talking about the retailers, and you report that retailers like the ones that you named in your story, Target, Home Depot, J.Crew, Ralph Lauren, Costco, could refuse to allow companies with labor violations to truck their goods. Instead, they have let shipping and logistics contractors hire the lowest bidder while lobbying on behalf of trucking companies in Sacramento and Washington. You report that Walmart, Target, and dozens of other Fortune 500 companies have paid lobbyists up to $12.6 million to fight legislation that would have held companies liable or given drivers a minimum wage and other protections that most workers already receive. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So we have, like I was saying, we have, I don't want to give away the whole farm because we have a story coming out in a week that dives much deeper into that paragraph. And, you know, what we have found is that the status quo for a lot of the supply chain business models is sort of necessary for the, you know, efficient and cheap movement of goods. So they look at, you know, retailers look at the business models that the trucking companies are using, the independent contractors, and they see it as an efficient, low-cost way of moving these goods. And a lot of the legislation that's tried to come out has tried to give these truck drivers more employee rights. A lot of the bills would have converted them wholesale to employees. Others would have made it easier for the labor commissioner to punish bad trucking companies and stuff like that. And what they are really looking at, I think, is sort of what organized labor has done on the other side of the fence. There's the longshoremen who have been such a pivotal player anytime during a contract negotiation. Whenever they decide to slow down or just strike, it can mean quite a headache for a lot of these retailers. And they've kind of seen what the Teamsters have tried to do in organizing these guys on the other side of the fence, the truck drivers. So I think that there's a lot of resistance to any sort of tectonic shift in the business model that these trucking companies are using, and that's where sort of this lobbying voice has come out. They work closely with the trucking associations to figure out what makes the most sense and what could ultimately hurt them in the long run. And if there's a lot of employee truck drivers again, like there were before 1980, that could mean more actions, more strikes. It's just another part of the supply chain that they don't necessarily want to see go into union hands, and that sort of played out in Sacramento and D.C.
And are California politicians on this issue? Do they know that this is happening? Can you name any politicians who are actually taking action on this issue? Or are any California politicians receiving this money from these corporations to fight these bills?
So the direct link with the lobbyists and their actions doesn't necessarily, from what I've seen, go to any lawmakers. It's mostly just kind of lobbying firms that had actually been working at the port before moving into the revolving door of the lobbying side. So it's not so much that as as much as just having voices down there through their lobbyists. There's sort of like a sea of them of them operating down there. But there has, they do kind of know what's going on. They have for a while, I think. There's been, different demonstrations. The different workers' rights groups have raised this before. I don't think before our story anyone has ever kind of put it all together in the same sort of light, and suggested the scope of it. But I think certainly there have been some lawmakers, I think of Perez and Congressman Swanson, who have tried pushing bills on this on their behalf back when Kamala Harris was the Attorney General. She had brought some actions against these companies up in Oregon. Congressman DeFazio has tried pushing some federal bills to this end. So they've been kind of seeing things happen. They've been hearing, and they've been trying to, once in a while, move some bills that might help these guys, but it's been slow coming. There's a lot of legal weight behind doing anything like that. Like I was saying, the big trucking associations have really a vested interest in this, and they've fought a lot of different legal battles on the states and local rights to regulate this industry. It's been deregulated for so long. Anytime a new rule is going to come in, it's going to meet some fierce opposition.
We're speaking today with Brett Murphy. He's an investigative reporter with USA Today, and he spent an entire year looking at the exploitation of truckers in the United States. And he found trucking companies force drivers to work against their will up to 20 hours a day by threatening to take their trucks and keep the money they paid toward buying them. To keep drivers working, managers at a few companies have physically barred them from going home. Brett, you report that more than once, Marvin Figueroa returned from a full day's work to find the gate to the parking lot locked and a manager ordering drivers back to work. In 2015, in a labor case, he testified, quote, "That was how they forced me to continue working," end quote. You report that truckers at two other companies have made similar claims, and you tried to reach out to these trucking companies. You contacted 30, but many did not respond or declined to comment.
Yeah, that's right. And the those examples you listed there are sort of the most extreme kind of cases of this leverage that companies have over their drivers. And I think they're kind of illustrative in that way, that they show just how bad it can get when you have sort of no agency in this situation. And what those situations sort of show or exemplify is that they don't have any choice but to really listen to what their bosses say, and in those cases, the driver said that they wanted to go home. Federal regulation says that you can only drive for 11 hours a day. They had been well over that at that point, 16, 18 hours, a couple of them, and they came back and they wanted to go home. And what that situation shows is that the company owners can say, well, if you do go home right now, then you can't come back tomorrow, or you can't work this week, or you'll be fired. So sometimes they actually had, we found that they actually went out there and they locked the gate, or they stood out there in the parking lot and they were waving guys back into the road. And I sat down with a couple of these drivers where I read their testimony, and they said that they had no choice but to go back onto the road, because they knew if they didn't, they would get fired and they would lose all of that investment I was talking about before. That's tens of thousands of dollars. Their whole livelihood is tied up into this thing. So then their whole livelihood gets tied up into this moment where the boss decides whether or not they can go home. So that was sort of the most extreme stuff we found, and we thought it was some of the more egregious cases. That's why it's sort of more illustrative. And when we reached out to the companies, the ones that did agree to speak with us, you know, said for the most part, listen, you found the guys who are disgruntled. There are lots of people who have found success in this industry. They're more diligent and industrious workers. They've made it through their lease to own contracts. They own the truck now and they're happy. I did talk to a few drivers where that was indeed the case. They also said that, listen, we were in a rock and a hard place there in 2008 when I was talking about those environmental regulations. We had to move to this business model just to stay above water. The truckers were all going to lose their shirts. We were going to lose ours. So this was a way to keep it, you know, to make sure everyone kept their job. That's why we did this. And for the most part, it worked out. You, Brett, you just found the bad cases. So that was sort of their defense we heard a lot of the times. They also kind of cast it as a large, union organizing effort. You know, this is the Teamsters. All these accounts you have found are exaggerated or manufactured because the Teamsters would like to organize the port drivers again and get some more members. So they also said that. Those are sort of the three big defenses I heard time and again.
Again, you pieced together accounts from more than 300 drivers, listened to hundreds of hours of sworn labor dispute testimony, and reviewed contracts that have never been seen by the public. Speaking of unions, we have an email from Art who says, how can independent truckers use unions and other associations of workers to fight back? He also writes, the Teamsters have been working with port drivers. How is that going?
Yeah, so this week, that's a good question. This week, the port drivers, a few of them, a few dozen, I think it was anywhere between 60 and 100 down there, went on strike with the Teamsters. And what's really interesting about this whole thing is that one of the rights you lose as an independent contractor, as a non-employee, is the right to collectively organize. So as an independent contractor, you don't have the legal right to join a union. You don't have the legal right to go on strike. So a lot of these guys will do it anyway because they have the support of the Teamsters who are down there trying to organize them. But it's just another little twist in this whole thing is that they can't get together, like three of them or four of them, and go to their boss and ask for more money or for better pay or for better conditions. They don't have the legal right to do so as an independent contractor. And that's why the Teamsters have tried to kind of step back in there and regain some ground they lost before 1980. Like I was saying, this whole industry, trucking, long haul, short haul, port guys, it all used to be Teamsters, Teamster jobs, union jobs. Mm. And the union is back in there trying to regain some ground they had lost. And it's been slow going, but this strike, I think, was one of their largest they've had in a long time. They brought it right to the mayors of LA and Long Beach. And I think they even reached out to the retailers as well, the customers.
And we have another email from a listener who says, are you familiar with the book Sweatshops on Wheels? It was about the plight of the long-haul owner-operators. And if you are familiar with that, have conditions changed since it was written?
That's Michael Belzer's book, I believe. I read it when I was first researching this thing. And that speaks to what happened to the industry as a whole. Back right after 1980, when everyone became an independent contractor, no one was driving for the big companies anymore as employees. They were all sort of entering this market, and it became what Belzer notes in the book was sort of a classic race to the bottom. Companies can now choose who they wanted to move their goods and for what price. and they knew if you weren't willing to do it for that price, they could find somebody who would. So everyone was just sort of racing to undercut one another and underbid one another, and it sort of created this downward pressure of lower and lower pricing. So what used to be kind of a good-paying job turned into a race to the bottom with really high turnover because everything was so hyper-competitive. There was no floor on the market, and there was nobody setting really any rules anymore. So because of that, it's not the job it once was, which is what Belzer sort of notes. Here at the port, what we found here was sort of the really ugly side of that, just the what could happen in a completely deregulated market that suddenly becomes regulated without everyone thinking it all the way through. So that environmental regulation I keep talking about was a really sudden sort of lightning strike in what had been sort of a no-rules industry before that.
You report that these trucking companies are used to move goods for some of the country's most beloved retailers, Costco, Target, Home Depot. This is stuff that people buy on a regular basis. What can the public do to raise awareness about this or to change this?
Yeah, the stuff that comes in through these ports, it's about half of all America's container goods. So, a shirt, furniture, pretty much anything manufactured in the Pacific Rim is coming through L.A., Long Beach, and then it's going all over the country. It can end up in Florida or Nashville or Maine. It goes everywhere. So the scale of it is pretty massive. These two ports together, which are side by side down in L.A. Harbor, are the biggest in the Western Hemisphere together, and each of them by themselves are number one and two in the country. So it's huge. It's a whole city down there. As far as what people can do, that's, I don't think, is a really good question that I can answer. I'm not, I'm not an advocate for really any of this. I'm just sort of here to kind of tell everyone what's going on. What I would suggest doing is just to keep reading about it and to kind of stay aware of where your goods are made. What goes into that shirt or that armchair or something.
Well, the USA Today editorial board writes that in 21st century America, no workers should be treated like 19th century sharecroppers. They're indebted to their employers and work up to 20 hours a day for pay that can drop to pennies per hour. Brett Murphy is a reporter with the USA Today Network. He spent a year looking at the exploitation of truckers in the U.S. It's called Rigged, an incredible report with photos from Omar O'Neilius and video. Brett Murphy, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your reporting.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. And coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance's Stacy Mitchell about the rise of corporate monopolies. Five banks control about 47% of the country's banking assets. Four airlines dominate the skies, and just six corporations control 90% of the media. So how are monopolies changing the economic system? That is on Monday. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.